Session number 10782, Reel 1.
Mr. Bank, Reel 1. Can you tell me how you came to be in the Navy in the first place, please, and why you joined up?
Well, from the age of 18, I had intended to go to sea as a marine engineer. Serving my time in a Glasgow shipyard, this gave me the foundation for this career. But in 1938, shortly after the Munich crisis, Westminster passed a conscription bill. And when I studied this, I saw that I was right in the first group to be called on. And I had a terror of being a soldier. So on further investigation, I found I could volunteer for Royal Naval Special Reserve.
Your terror of being a soldier related to what had happened in the First World War?
I didn't want to be a foot slogger. No, the Army didn't appeal to me at all. The Navy was sea. A seafaring life was my ambition.
And I think the organisation you joined was a rather unusual one.
It was very unusual. The Navy had created it to cream off, which I saw once I joined the 500 people who were called, that they were all excellent young men. Obviously, the Navy had picked out the best physical crowd they could, you see. It was obvious when you saw them doing gymnastics and sporting activities, and even our regular Royal Naval instructors, you know, real old grizzled PO types. Used to hear them commenting, I wish we could get 500 or 1,000 more of the lads of this calibre, you know.
And it was called the Royal Naval Special Reserve.
That's it, yes.
And what was the date you actually joined?
The 26th of June, 1939, I enrolled on that reserve. And then the 9th month, 39, I was called, I beg your pardon, that was to Devonport. He'll be able to rub white dust, won't he?
No, it's all right, we can correct it now.
I actually reported on the 26th of June, 39, to Devonport, but I'd been enrolled 3 months previously, locally, you know, and I'd passed the trade test. I had to prove I was a fit and tanner by doing a piece of engineering, which was a standard trade test for engine room artificers. I had to pass that before I'd be accepted. And also a physical and a 3 hours test to make sure you weren't completely moronic. So I actually went into uniform on the 26th of June, 39. Did disciplinary training at Devonport.
What was that like?
All square bashing, rifle drill, work in the gymnasium, all physical. Mainly physical. Boat pulling. We did a bit of boat sailing a whaler, big ungainly thing with 12 men in it, you know. Football, cricket, very, very physical 6 weeks, and how to salute an officer, and the usual, the bum for your yacht. And when that was completed on the ninth month, that was when my training finished, I was transferred to Portsmouth, HMS Victory.
That was in September,
yeah.
When the war was declared.
The war was declared, yes.
What was your reaction to the declaration of war?
Wasn't surprised at all, because all the instructors had been telling us repeatedly that we were going to be engaged in a war with Germany. The fellows that were disciplining us at Devonport kept telling us that we were could have a war, and that was it.
Did they say anything to you about the calibre of the German Navy?
Yes, we were shown photographs of the ships that were in use then, U-boats, and they had high respect for it. But personally, I must say I was very neutral in my feelings about it. I can't remember having any apprehension at all.
What was the first ship that you actually joined?
HMS Icarus. There's the crest on the wall there.
Can you tell me about her, what she was like?
Yes, I can show you a photograph. I can give you the details of her build if you wish that.
Yes, please.
Icarus. Built in 1937. Commissioned in 1937 at John Brown's Clydebank Yard.
She was a destroyer, was she?
High class destroyer, yeah. 1370 tons, small ships compared to today's. Had twin screw geared turbines, three boilers. Capable of 35 knots, 4.47-inch guns, 8.5-inch, 8.5 AA guns, and she had 8 21-inch torpedo tubes, torpedoes. So she, although she was 3 years old, she was still considered to be a modern fleet destroyer at that date.
What would she like to live and work aboard, from your point of view?
She was exceptionally well built. The engine room was beautifully laid out. Everything was so handy. You could stand at one particular point on the control part and you could read every gauge by just by doing a 360 turn of the head, you know. With no trouble mechanically with her. She was stood some great abuse at sea and I had very, very, very little trouble with it. We never missed a trip to sea except on one occasion. And managed to, you know, when we were given orders to go, we always went. But on one occasion, we'd been at sea, we'd gone off to sea, and on the HP turbines, there was a series of drain valves which had to be opened while we were manoeuvring, you see. For technical reasons, these drains had to be opened in case condensate steam in the form of water collected. And the blades hit it, whether they would smash them or distorted them. And the stoker came back and I instructed him to go and shut the drains. He came back and said, the middle drain on the starboard HP turbine won't close. Oh, anyway, when we got settled down at a steady pace at sea, I went and investigated this and I couldn't close it. And the pipe from the valve was red hot, which indicated it was passing steam. Couldn't shut it during that operation. It was open all the time. Great waste, you see. The steam went into the condenser and loss of heat. Anyway, first time in harbour, I went down underneath and undid the valve. The engine had been shut down several hours, everything was cool. And as I took the cover off the valve, a 6-inch hand file came out with it. I thought, yeah, I know, I'm an engineer's file. This was disastrous.
How had that got there?
No idea. Must have been from a previous refit in the dockyard, something like that. That was all we could put it down to. But it stopped us going to sea.
Was it accident or sabotage?
Oh, accident, I would think. I can't imagine. You couldn't get in. The turbine would have to be opened. Huge, massive job. It must have been at the last opening of the turbine when that was happened. Somebody working on it had lost the file, you see. It dropped down into the bottom. Fortunately, the blades weren't damaged. We were very lucky. They went to the trouble of opening the turbine, you know, because of it. But that was the only time we'd any panic. All the other work was pretty routine, you know.
Was it a clean engine room?
Very cool. We kept it immaculate, yes. We were very proud of it. The boiler rooms in it, the three boiler rooms, all separate, subdivided into each of the watertight compartment. And the engine room, we took a great pride in it and polished it. And sometimes we couldn't because of the bad weather, because of a very, very rough ships at sea, you know, you had to be a good sailor.
Did you ever have any merchant navymen in the engine room on Icarus?
No. No.
Was working in the engine room a popular or an unpopular job in the Navy, in the wartime?
I don't think upper deck people envied us in any way. And I must admit that I was always very conscious of these two huge steam pipes above my head, which I could touch, you know. I think they were 8-inch bore, but of course they had about 6 inches of insulation around them, made them huge, and I could just touch them. I was always conscious of these two, with any action. And I said, I hope nothing comes through the side and hits one of those pipes. I lost sight of the fact the thing might have hit me, but it didn't occur that way.
Just the fear of being scalded?
I'd always, because we had the pressure gauge there, 300 pounds per square inch, 675 degrees Fahrenheit, constantly in view, you see. And I've often looked at those and thought, God, one of these pipes go, there'd be curtains for everybody in this compartment. But I found the job extremely absorbing, and both its weight in gold and experience from an engineering angle, because we did everything on the ship, produced our own water from the sea, distilled it in an evaporating plant. We had to keep the lube oil free of condensation. We had separator for, you know, separating the lube oil and separating the water out. We distilled the water to feed the boilers from the sea as well through the same evaporating plant. So we were either distilling water for freshwater tank for drinking, for domestic use, or for feeding boilers.
When was the first time you were in action after the war was declared? Was that at Norway?
Yes. We were sent to mine the March 40, were sent to mine Norwegian territorial waters to force the German ore-carrying ships coming down the coast out into, you know, non-territorial waters so that we could have a go at them and sink them.
What happened on that trip?
Well, we laid our mines, and then we were instructed to join up with heavier forces that were off the coast to assist escort duties, and we ran into one of the German major ships at dawn one day, and I remember we were rushing to action stations when we were straddled with 8-inch shells, Icarus, either side of us. I remember these huge spouts, couldn't understand it. We were told later that was a gunfire from, I'm not sure which one it was, Scharnhorst, Geisner, one of those, not sure which. But we eventually were sent back to Resife, and we loaded troops, 40 or 50 troops, and dashed back to Norway with them, and dropped them off up a small fjord. Not too sure where it was, actually. Everything was so confusing. And we were then... there was then a oiling base set up with two fleets, oil tankers, somewhere up the West Fjord. We went there for fuel, and we finished up patrolling back and forward across the West Fjord, two of us, two destroyers, back and forward, a fairly wide stretch of water. And the First Battle of Narvik took place, and we saw, when we went back in for fuel the next time, the Havoc and one or two of the other ships that had been in the first battle were laid there, damaged. You could see the damage on them, you see. We went back out, and on Thursday night, the 11th of April, just before midnight, we were always a semi-prepared state, but we went to full action stations about quarter to midnight, as there was a large ship approaching from the south, thought to be a German cruiser. It turned out to be a motor ship Ulster, SS Ulster, a large 25,000-ton German merchant ship, supply ship for the German forces in Narvik at that time. Anyway, we took it as a prize, and I happened to be off watch that night. That was after a fire and repair party. And I saw the whole thing. We went belting down in an opposite course to her and swung round and came alongside the port side. And as we touched, our boarding party managed to get from the forecastle into our forward well deck, at just about the same height. Somebody started firing from the bridge down at our bridge, and there was a burst of machine gun fire from Icarus's bridge. And that stopped that racket. Then there was a most awful explosion between our ship and this German ship. They'd lowered the demolition charge over the side and it had gone off. Knocked our main breakers out. Everything went off, of course. And a few minutes dashing around to get this org sorted out. And our boarding party had gone aboard. There was one ERA and three or four stoker petty officer for the engine room, you see. And we didn't know about this till afterwards, but when they got down there, there was a large door off the condenser and there was seawater pouring in. And it was obvious to us on board that this large ship was starting to heel over, as you say. And she must have had 50 or 60 tons of coke, deck cargo, in the after well deck, and that started falling down on us from a great height. Big lumps of coke, side of your fist. And it was rather funny afterwards, thinking about it, but we moved up forward and took her in tow. And we could make 5 knots pulling this huge thing. And we pulled it all night. And about 7 o'clock next morning, we finished up where these two fleet tankers, fuel tankers were. And that she had smoke coming out her funnel by this time. Our crowd had managed to stop the leak. And forced the Germans to light the boilers and got bilge pumps running. And by 7 o'clock in the morning, she was almost on an even keel. And we went alongside and we were going to take off our boarding party, but we were suddenly told to go to the aid of HMS Effingham. The light cruiser was in trouble. And we made it was about a 3 hours dash. I remember that particularly because we were full speed on two boilers at 25 knots, and we came up this field, and Effingham was laid across the field, apparently undamaged, sure to be undamaged. But the funny thing was, when we pulled alongside her, all the ship's company were standing there with all their gear, all packed, and they all piled aboard orderly. And of course, naturally, what's the buzz? What's going on? Well, we're stuck. They'd run onto a submerged rock and pushed the engine room up, and she couldn't do anything. So we pulled away, and as we were steaming down the field, it must have been about 2 miles away when she went up, and the forward and aft magazines went up, they'd scuttled her. She just sank out of sight. Went back to the base. And went alongside the Ulster. They'd opened the access door lower in the ship, you know, there's passenger access door. And we put all the Effingham's people aboard. And we had 6 of the Germans off the Ulster on board who'd been injured for our doctor to attend to them. And we'd taken them with us on this trip and brought them back. And they were actually sat in our mess. Next to the little sick bay, we were in the same flat, and the doctor said, can we sit these fellas in here? I haven't room for them in here. When he and one patient were in, it was full, you see. Anyway, it was obvious that the young ones were, they were arrogant, Heil Hitler types, but the two elderly Germans, they accepted a meal and thoroughly enjoyed it, but the three younger ones, in their 20s, they wouldn't have a thing. They wouldn't even have a drink. Very militant, you know. And so we put them all back aboard their own ship. And next thing, we were ordered to go on patrol, go back on patrol, you see. That would be Friday, the 12th of April. And late on that night, we got orders that we had to go and meet a force coming up from the south, who were going to attack the German forces, the destroyers in Narvik next day. an odd job was to sweep a channel for them up the fjord, because we had a special sweeping gear fitted to the bow protection gear. It was a large arm on the starboard side that could be lowered down, and you strained your paravanes from that, you see, and it gave your ship a bit of protection as well from mines. So at 7 o'clock next morning, it was a marvellous sight to see the Warspite and 8 tribal destroyers coming up the field there. 8 destroyers in line, you know, and a big ship behind them. Because we had a real destroyer skipper on Icarus in those days, a chap called Maud, Lieutenant Commander Maud.
How did he spell his name?
M-A-U-D, Maud. And he was a real destroyer skipper, you know.
In what sense?
Real aggressive, dashing, you know, he'd be in like a shot and so on, belting down towards this force coming up, and he's did a real smart turn to get in front, and we were about a mile and a half ahead, and they'd practice this dropping these minesweeping tackle so many times they were down and out in no time. And we set to, and we went to action stations then, and of course mine was down in the number one boiler room. There was a big air compressor that supplied air at very high pressure for torpedoes, which we hadn't any because we'd be converted to mine laying. But I had to run this thing and tend it, and on the other side there was a standby generator in case the main ones were damaged, you see. So as far as I was concerned, the Narvik was just a series of explosions and funny movements on the telegraph. Because when the engine room got instructions to alter speed anyway, it was recorded on a telegraph back to the boiler room, so the stoker petty officer could adjust his burners on his furnace to suit the demand, you see. So I spent most of the time down there and just a series of peculiar rushing around like mad.
How frightening was it for you?
Well, the biggest thing was not knowing what was happening. There was no communication whatsoever except between engine room and the boiler room. There was no tannoy on the ship. It was so old-fashioned in a way that all orders that were piped, the boatswain's mate had to go around the ship blowing his pipe and shouting the instruction, you see. So that was the big thing. What the hell's happening? But about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, engine room rang through and said, number two boiler's got a complaint. Go across and see what it is. Well, as I emerged from the hatch, we were in very narrow waters. But when I look at the map and read the history of the thing, we were entering the Rombach Fjord beyond Narvik, in a very narrow inlet into it. And I'm just coming out the hatch, coming out these boiler rooms, you know, the boiler's under pressure, pressurised by the fans which provide the draft and the whole, you've got to go through an airlock. You get on the top grating, open the door, and as you open the door there's two holes exposed in the air and the airlock, and the boiler room equalise. Then you can open the door easily, get in, shut the door. And then there's the round hatch to be opened up a straight ladder onto the deck. Well, as I come out the deck, there was a terrific explosion ahead of us. What the hell? So I must admit, I dashed over to the guardrail and had a look. And it was the Eskimo had a bow blown off by a torpedo from the four German destroyers that had gone dashing up. And on the port side, when I looked over to the port side, the Hans Ludemann, German destroyer, was up on the beach. She must have hit the beach at a terrific speed, you see, and had ridden up. And at the head of the field, there was three more ships all beached, burning furiously. And you could see the German crews wandering away across the snow, making for goodness knows where. Anyway, I went down and effected the little repair that was the stoker petty officer was complaining about. And on the way back to the forward bar room had turned around, were coming out of Rombach Fair by this time, and there was no more activity for another. I was down there for another couple of hours, and we got in Fallout Action Station. So that was the end of the Narvik escapade, as far as I was concerned. We proceeded out to sea that night, and we, as a mine layer, you see, when we'd been converted to mine laying, they'd taken off A gun and Y gun, forward and aft guns, taking the two sets of torpedo tubes off to compensate for the 120 mines that we would carry, with 60 either side. And the upper deck had rails welded to it, and we had mines from the stern right up to the after funnel when we were loaded. And we had a little conveyor system at each end at the back, which used to drop them off alternately, you see. All I had to do was to push them up, and this chain with a lug on it would catch the back of the sinker and push it off until they're all gone.
What was your action station?
The first year, when I was under training, before I had got my watchkeeping ticket, was in the forward boiler room attending these machines to be available there if needed for any repair work. And then when I picked up an engine room watch, we had a system where one watchkeeper in the engine room, when he came off watch, he went aft after fire and repair party, or forward fire and repair party, whatever you were, you know, detail to go to. I generally finished up after fire and repair party when I was off watch. There was that comprised of about six people, a leading stoker, and five or six stokers. We had a huge bag with all sorts of plugs and wooden wedges and some battens of timber, a big hammer, and just for shoring up bulkheads, things like that. But I also had a hold all, something like yours, full of tools as well, and available.
Now,